I went into the department chair's office and said, where can I go? I only speak English, so that's my limitation. And we had an exchange program at the University of Maine. I grew up in a country, I think, that's quite welcoming of travelers. I want to do a grad degree somewhere in commuting distance of Utica, New York. Got any ideas? And he knew Paul Hopkins, who was at ESF. And so I reached out to Paul. And, you know, I have memories of snowshoeing out to look at, you know, locate forest plots to do reference data collection for remote sensing studies when I was a grad student. Do you like physics? Do you like math? Do you like working outdoors? Surveying as a career for you? The rest is kind of history.
Welcome. This is Joni Mahoney, and I am with my first faculty member that I get to interview on my podcast. And I am very grateful that Dr. Lindy Quackenbush has agreed to be first. So you're very brave. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
I think the best thing to do is to just ask you to introduce yourself. So folks know what your role here is at ESF.
I currently serve as the chair of the Department of Environmental Resources Engineering. I've been at ESF since 95. Came in as a master's degree student, worked through my that degree, worked in a staff position for a couple of years before I joined the faculty while I was still working on my PhD, actually.
And what is your PhD in?
Remote sensing and image processing. You know, my degree was focused on looking at impervious surface classification and looking at types of impervious surfaces and trying to see if we could do a better job. Things that we do as humans really well, it's still computationally challenging that I can look at an image and classify a road, a roof, and different types of impervious surfaces. Computationally, it's still more challenging than the human brain's pretty powerful.
Where did you spend your time as a child?
Yeah, so I was born in the suburbs of Melbourne. We moved out of Melbourne when I was three. My dad was the head teacher at a local elementary school. And so we moved into the school residence and lived in the school residence adjacent to the school. One-room schoolhouse. We grew to two-room schoolhouse. The school, the largest in my 6 years there, got to 42 students. I never had more than five in my grade, and that was in a big year. It was very personalized that, you know, dad was the head teacher when I was in kindergarten. Dad was the head teacher when I was in sixth grade. I was thinking about it the other day, and of the five students in my grade, I'm the only one that went on to college or university. The others went into trades and things like that. The expectation of me was different than the expectation of them.
Because you were the daughter of the educator.
And just because I was good at math. So let's push you further. And then I went from there into a regional high school that there were 250 kids in my grade.
That must have been quite the culture shock.
It was the culture shock. And I learned very quickly in my elementary school, if you got asked a question, you raised your hand and you answered it. You do that in a bigger high school and you get labeled as a nerd really quickly.
I can still remember the students that raised their hand in the front of the classroom. But that obviously, from your perspective as a teacher, is something you would probably love in a student.
Oh, so, absolutely. Yeah. Getting students talking. And you got to get them talking to each other first. The, you know, sort of having them sitting there and making them talk to me is a lot harder than having them talk to each other. And then they're more unlikely to share because they've already sort of gone over the, is this a reasonable answer question?
So what brought you from Australia to the United States?
I did my undergrad degree in surveying at Melbourne Uni. I actually have two bachelor's degrees. That was very common at the time. About half of Melbourne Uni's student population was doing two bachelor's degrees. Mine was surveying. It's a bachelor of surveying as well as a bachelor of science. And so I was working on that five-year degree program. And I wanted to go abroad, but the honest truth was I was dating a guy. And then when he dumped me, I went into the department chair's office and said, where can I go? I only speak English, so that's my limitation. And we had an exchange program at the University of Maine. So my first year in the U.S. was at the University of Maine.
So is that your senior year of college, your final year?
It was my fourth of 5 years because of the dual program. So I did my fourth year in Maine and then went back to Australia and did my fifth year. Maine was a great experience. And I worked in the summer in Boston for an engineering firm there and then worked as an undergrad teaching assistant in the second semester that I was there. I wouldn't be generous enough to call it spring in Orono in Maine in January, but
the second semester
I was there.
So how did you like that?
It was a really great experience. I arrived, I had a job that started on the Monday. I didn't know where I was going to stay. I had no accommodation lined up. I was couch surfing with the sister of somebody else temporarily. Went to the office to work out how I would get there on Monday morning, and found one of the employees there heading out on a 3-month out of town jaunt who was willing to sublet his apartment to me. So I moved into an apartment.
Oh my gosh, Lindy, you are brave.
I look at it now, well, I'm not quite sure if brave is the right word, but you know, I had no cell phone, no credit card.
Because I also did a semester abroad when I was in college, but I didn't get that full experience that you just described. I didn't stay and do the internship as you did in Boston, or do the TA role, which I would imagine gave you a much broader perspective on the United States.
My dad had a philosophy of, I had to do what he said when he said it until I turned 18. And then after that, I was an adult and I could do what I want, where I wanted. He just didn't want to hear about it. And so I think oblivion was probably the safety net for them, that you're dialing in the payphone with, you know, 75 cents a minute and quarters.
Oh my goodness.
Was sort of how I reached them for the while. So I suspect they didn't really know exactly where I was, but.
Or that you didn't have a place to live or transportation to the job in the city you had never experienced before.
I had bought a car. I'd never owned a car in Australia. I never needed one. Public transportation in Melbourne was very good. I had a Subaru hatchback that I put 10,000 miles on that summer.
Had you whet your appetite for the United States at that point? Did you think you'd be back?
I had met my now husband.
In Boston or in Maine?
In Maine. He was he finished his undergrad degree. He has an undergrad degree in surveying as well. And so I met him in Maine. He graduated in the May and moved back to Utica. And so I went back to Australia and reached out to Ray Heinz, one of the faculty at the University of Maine, and said, I want to do a grad degree somewhere in commuting distance of Utica, New York. Got any ideas? And he knew Paul Hopkins, who was at ESF. And so I reached out to Paul, and the rest is kind of history.
That is such an interesting story. And how great for us at ESF that your life took that circuitous path and you came here and then got your master's, as you said, and then worked here while you were working at a PhD. And then started out as an instructor or a research associate?
I started out as a lecturer, a non-tenure track title, while I was working on my PhD. And Bill Tully, the provost at the time, had said to me, when you finish your PhD, you know, come and see me. And so I went from my defense to his office and said, I defended successfully. Can we talk about changing title?
And
so I did.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people would benefit from hearing you describe how you got where you wanted to be. And, you know, obviously an advocate for yourself. I knew that you had a much better history here at ESF and could help me as the new incoming president, but I had no idea how deep. You've seen this college through a lot of different lenses as a grad student, as an employee, as a PhD candidate, as, you know, somebody who worked your way up through the line of succession all the way to now chairing ERE. So right now, are you in a position where you're able to continue your research as a chair?
To some degree, that I certainly still have graduate students working, and you know, I spend more time as an editor than doing research, I sometimes feel like. But yeah, I had two PhD students finish last year, and I have a couple sort of working now, and it's through them that I'm largely keeping engaged in research.
So how about your connection with students here now? How do students connect with you? How are you able to connect with them? I imagine in the classroom because you're teaching, but outside the classroom, do you feel like you have a pretty good connection with students on this campus?
So for our undergrads, I teach our first year fall and spring sequence. So I get to know the first year students there. I regret that I don't get to teach, you know, I don't have time to teach an upper division course because I certainly got to know the students even better there. I also am the faculty advisor for the ERE Club. So I sort of get to know some of the students through that part of it as well. And then we always have our ERE Club takes a trip up to the Adirondacks in the fall semester. And I try to make sure, you know, I go on that to be able to get to see the students outside the classroom, because I think that's really, you know, important. For my grad students, you know, we meet every week, and I do one-on-one meetings with all of my grad students to try dear, to keep their research moving and to keep me honest. And you know, sorry, I didn't get to look at this year, this week, but I have to look at you and tell you that rather than just send an email and say, I didn't get to this week.
And I imagine that like everyone, you get really busy. And then when somebody is with you right in front of you on a weekly basis, it does tend to keep you moving. Where do you go up in the Adirondacks with the ERE students?
To the AEC.
Okay. So Newcomb. We are having our board meeting at Newcomb in September because a lot of our board members haven't seen our satellite properties. And I was talking yesterday to the organization that's updating our facility master plan about how this is such a tremendous asset for our college, and our competitors that are in this same space don't have that real world field experience that they can offer students. So I would imagine that your ERE students just love that experience of being up there.
We use them in non-physical ways as well, that the forest data that's collected up there, we've been publishing with that data for years. And some of my students, I always try to make sure they always get up there at least once. But, you know, I have memories of snowshoeing out to look at, you know, locate forest plots to do reference data collection for remote sensing studies when I was a grad student.
And the whole world of remote sensing has changed so much since your time as a grad student that keeping up on the technology has probably also been interesting.
Yeah, very much so.
Is there something that you can point to looking back where you say that launched my career, that launched my passion?
Well, I think part of it was, you're absolutely growing up that way, and I was never discouraged to learn. My parents were both teachers, and so that was certainly, education was important. But growing up in Australia, there's sort of a different, everybody doesn't have to go to university. You know, going into the trades, there were lots of opportunities and there were lots of career paths. But it was, you know, it was clear that I was heading in that way, and I was encouraged right from the start. And it never occurred to me not to be positive about education. And every time I hear someone sort of say, you know, oh, you know, girls get taught they're not good at math, and I'm kind of like, I never heard that. And I get mad when people reinforce that, because I don't think that that's true of a lot of teachers sort of looking to grouping students into the way, you know. But I certainly had a very unusual experience. But I think what changed my path was actually getting into the upper end of high school. I was going to be a dietitian.
Really?
I had my career mapped out, and then I took chemistry and decided I didn't like chemistry and I didn't want to pursue chemistry. And there was a brochure in one of the education flyers that said, do you like physics? Do you like math? Do you like working outdoors? Surveying is a career for you. And I kind of went, okay, I hadn't even thought about surveying. And I went and visited a couple of local surveying firms and ended up working in summers for one of those people when I was in college in the end.
It says a lot about you, you know, how many people would see the same flyer and not hear, oh, that is exactly what I'm interested in. It didn't say chemistry. I am interested in physics and math and the outdoors.
Right.
And I have this impression, unfortunately, I've never been to Australia, but I have this impression of Australia where there is a love of the outdoors. I don't know if it's just what is curated for us to watch on TV about Australia, but it does seem like a place where people really appreciate nature and the outdoors.
Well, we certainly did. I could probably have count the number of times I stayed in a hotel in Australia on one hand, that my family's vacations were always camping. Dad was members of the local four-wheel drive club, so we did a lot of car camping into some really remote areas. But then I also did a lot of hiking. I had the option to take outdoor education as an elective. And my dad had said to me, you either do PE or you do outdoor ed. I don't care which one, but you have to do something that keeps you active. And so I picked outdoor ed, and we did rock climbing and we did canoeing and ski touring.
So I'm wondering about your role models. Is there anybody that you met or saw along the way that really inspired you in your career?
Lots of people in different ways. And as I said, the surveyor that I talked to here, who ended up later employing me, was probably 30 years ago, said to me, you have to take GIS. You have to get into GIS. This is going to be really important going forward. And he was absolutely right. And so it's certainly sort of, you know, pieces like that. I had a math teacher, Mr. Keane, who pushed me in ways that you've got to keep going. You know, I'd go and visit him trips home up until he passed away a couple of years ago. But then I also have, you know, the people who live down the road from me, the farmers who, when my parents were working, I would wander down to you know, Mr. and Mrs. Marshall's house and pick peas out of their garden.
You sound like you had this ideal childhood.
It was a very different experience. And 30, 40, 50, how many videos ago do I want to go? Years ago, people were a lot more secure. But I would, you know, I would walk from home, you know, down the road, you know, when we lived in the school residence, down to the neighbor's house. And there was never a concern about that. We used to, when we moved to the top of the hill, and I used to ride my bike. It was about 4 or 5 miles to school. And you just ride downhill, you know, up until I had to catch the bus into town for high school. But there was a sense of security. You know, I mentioned there were 5 kids in my grade level. None of them were girls. There were no girls in the grade above me.
Really?
None in the grade above that, and only one in the grade below mine.
So you went to a boys' school.
Well, the other grade levels, different yeah. levels were more balanced. And we had a very small school. And then not very far away was another small school. And I got to know one of the girls that was in that school. And I could walk through the woods to her house. And Dad would just kind of like, yeah, just go down. When you catch the stream, you'll follow it down. And, you know, I sort of look at it now. And, you know, we were into orienteering when I was a kid. And I competed twice in the under 10s. And I sort of look at it now and think, would I send my kid out with a map and compass and good luck?
I don't know. Would you? You have 2 children?
Yes.
And they're school age still.
8th grade and 11th grade or going into.
I'm wondering if it's because time has changed things or if it's that way in Australia today. And if you were raising your children in Australia, you'd have a different impression.
I grew up in a country, I think, that's quite welcoming of travelers. You know, I often talk about my parents had, there was a group of 12 that they went to school together, coupled up, 6 couples. They all got married in the same calendar year. They were all still married. They all celebrate each year they do an anniversary trip. You know, they've all had their 50th wedding anniversaries now. But of them, all of their children have traveled overseas. Some of us are still based, you know, the one based in Hong Kong, I'm based over here, and there are others. Everybody traveled. But, and this sort of willingness to, if somebody says to you, oh, you're welcome to, you know, come and stay and visit. They do mean that. It's not just a, hi, how are you, that you hear people say and don't mean it. My dad was very much, you know, he took a year off after school and hitchhiked around the country and worked before he went back to school to become a teacher. And I think he just sort of, you know, you've got to be independent. He struggled when I left Australia, that was a, you know, it's a long way away.
Yeah. Do you get to see your parents very often now?
Before COVID, we were going reasonably, you know, we would see them reasonably often. And we met in LA 2 years ago. Fortunately, we had that planned. But it's been now 4 years since I've been back because of just the timing. We had planned on that trip and I would have gone somewhere in the last 2 years, but they're still not really open at the moment to even consider it. So,
do you have siblings?
I have 2 brothers.
And are they in Australia?
Yeah, one's on the west coast in Australia and one's just outside Sydney.
So your husband's from central New York and mm-hmm. your roots now are with him and where his family grew up in the Utica area?
Yeah, so we have a log cabin that we built on land that his grandparents owned. And I often joke about it, sort of say we built the log cabin, not we had it built for us, but we actually put the logs into place.
You did?
Which was another experience. So while I was a grad student, we were working on that. We had cleared the lot and then built the house.
Oh my goodness. So. Yeah. So you have the benefit of kind of both. You have somewhere where you have roots and you have your family here in the United States.
Yep.
And then that's very nice.
It's home both ways. I've now lived in the US longer than I lived in Australia, which was a really strange turning point when I hit that. When the Olympics come up, I'm definitely Australian.
Oh, really? Yeah,
absolutely.
How'd they just do in the last Olympics?
So they did, you know, I always think they do remarkably well when you think about the fact that Australia has a population less than a tenth the size of the US. And, you know, they were, you know, I think it was like 7th in the medal count or something like that. But,
nice.
You know, they do reasonably well. And I think that actually comes back to that idea of what Australians would think is important, that growing up, everybody was involved in things, that, you know, netball was the girls' sport, the most popular girls' sport in the area. But in my small community, which probably has, you know, 25,000 people in the rural area, you would have hundreds of girls every Saturday morning, all morning long, playing netball and, you know, football for the boys primarily in winter. But there was a place for everyone through adult level that I still have friends who are playing now in all sorts of leagues. And it's always been very much a getting people active. And
would you say that, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, there is a step along the way that you wish maybe you had taken the other fork in the road?
I don't know. I sometimes sort of feel like, you know, I look at people, you're contributing to the community, and I sort of think, should I have gone into medicine or something where I could give back more? I sometimes worry that I love what I do and I see the value on it, but I wouldn't be very good if you dropped me in, you know, a remote community somewhere and sort of said, you know, we've got sick people, help, or we've got here, sort of like, you know, huh, are there other things that I could have done to make myself, I don't know, more valuable to the outside world?
When you think about what's happening in the world right now, there isn't a bigger help than people that are studying nature and right. How to heal nature. I mean, none of us is going to be able to live here if we don't get scientists like you, your message resonating with people who are in policymaking places that can put the changes in place that we need. I tell people, my uncle was a climate scientist in the 1980s. He's since died, but I was watching the news last night with all the water in New York City and in Philadelphia, and the West Coast is on fire. And I said, you know, there are people like you, like a lot of the faculty at ESF, like my uncle, that have been ringing these alarm bells for a long time. And you have data that you've been collecting for all of these years, that once you have folks' attention and you can present that data in a compelling way, I don't think there's a more important mission than the mission of ESF right now. And you've got to be one of the leading voices here for this college. So I would disagree about whether you should have a different meaning for Dr. Lindy Quackenbush. I'm sure you would have been fabulous as a doctor, but thank goodness that you're focusing your attention on the environment and on environmental engineering in particular. I had the benefit as county executive of working with a lot of your students doing capstone projects on some of our mm-hmm. stormwater issues that we had in the county. And I say this and I mean it so sincerely. Your students changed the community, and I would argue the country, because we had the first consent order that dictated green infrastructure. We got that because of the expertise here at ESF. And then we did so many projects that were ideas that came from your students. And I have personally been in meetings in San Francisco and Philadelphia and New York City with teams that wanted to copy what we were doing. Yeah. And so when you think about those students that you're educating and how broad their impact already is, and how it's just going to be greater and greater all the time now, because we're finally getting the attention of people that, you know, these solutions are going to be what protects our kids and grandkids going forward.
Yeah, our students are amazing, and their willingness and interest in giving back. You know, all the students are involved in Engineers Without Borders and Engineers for a Sustainable Society, and the volunteer efforts that the club trips do when they're, you know, up at AEC. And I would not want to be trying to compete for a job with some of our students coming out of here, because their resumes are amazing.
I know. The resumes coming in are amazing.
Yeah.
I can't get over when I meet new students on campus this semester, some of the things that they've done. They're very mature and they're very, very much dedicated to the mission of the college. And how fun for them to be at a college where everybody's got the same mission.
Yeah.
You know, how do you think your students will remember you when they are sitting in front of a podcast a couple decades down the road and they're hearing about the people who influenced their lives? What do you think they will remember and take away from their experience here at ESF with you?
I think they will, a lot of them will talk about my attention to detail and being meticulous and caring about communicating. We start that, you know, at the lowest level. And, you know, I remember the first paper I had marked up by my advisor, and I thanked him and went home and cried. but it's something that I want students to be comfortable with. And so I think that they, you know, I've heard from alums that they'll see a presentation and be sort of like, I knew you would be really mad with the way somebody had done this. And, you know, there was too many exclamation points, and I don't use exclamation points in my writing. And so, you know, the things that sort of detail, and it doesn't really matter. You know, a lot of our alums, I taught surveying for a number of years, and they took surveying. And we just heard from an alum recently who was beating up his new employees because they hadn't taken surveying and they needed to take it, and they should have done it. And what I taught them was really useful. And, uh, But beyond that is sort of the ideas of, you know, just like I said, attention to detail.
That's an interesting way to be remembered, but it's crucial because you can know how to do all of the things that we need to do to move in the right direction. But if you can't communicate those things,
right,
it's, you know, you're not going to get policymakers, as I call them, to put the right solutions in place. So yeah. Communication is everything. I mean, once you become an expert in your field, if you want that to matter to others, you have to know how to communicate that. So you're doing them a service.
Yeah, well, and certainly the course that I teach in the spring semester is about engineering design, and it's about understanding our curriculum, but it's also about communication. And, you know, Matt Marco actually came into my class for a number of years to do guest lectures, sort of talking about, okay, what she's saying matters. Dave Gerber comes into my class regularly, both practicing engineers in the community,
right,
who have a connection to our program in different ways, but understanding that, you know, that what I'm saying, you know, really matters. And I can say it, and then they hear it from somebody outside and sort of think, oh,
exactly.
What was it she said? Because maybe I should have taken more notes on that.
But. Exactly. And you've come full circle on that part of the story with me, because it was actually Matt Marco who was introducing me to your students, mm-hmm, because he was meeting them, because you were having him come in the classroom. Right. He was introducing them to us. And then the federal judge who granted our request to use green infrastructure instead of the traditional methods that clearly haven't worked, it mattered to him that ESF was putting its stamp of approval on what we were doing. So I would say that you have had a tremendous impact on this community and more broadly, and your students are lucky to have been able to interact with you. I thank you for your time. And I'm hoping that people will get to know more about Lindy Quackenbush than they knew, despite the fact that you've been here, and I can tell you, 26 years. I know that because my oldest was born in 1995. So when you said that, I thought, okay, well, now I can keep that in mind. But thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
It's a pleasure to know you, and I am grateful that you work here.
Well, thank you.